Well, it's 8:14. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. My first guest, friends of the Hen Tag of the Weber River, Dylan Taggart, is on the line here to give us a midsummer update on just how things are going this season on this very popular stretch of the Weber River. Welcome, Dylan. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so give us a little bit of a rundown of your involvement with this organization first, and then maybe you can tell us about how things are going. There have been reports in the past, in fact, KPCW has reported on concerns there with respect to garbage and rowdiness and drunkenness on that particular stretch of river.
Well, it all started as an idea from a rafting guide that I had met on Facebook. His name is Michael Suggs. His idea was to start a Facebook group first and then hopefully turn it into something like a nonprofit. His initial idea was Friends of the Weber River, but we decided to scale that down to the Hen Tag because that's where the recreation is. That's where the people are. And that's where a lot of the problems are, too, because of that. So we decided that because the Hen Tag is 6 miles long and more probably easily managed than taking on the whole river, we decided that we would just start with that.
Okay. So it does span the Hen Tag, Hennifer to Taggart. It spans both Summit and Morgan counties, and it makes it a little bit more complicated for jurisdictional purposes. Tell us about how the stakeholders, who are the stakeholders, for first off, and how have they gotten involved to help address the issues that are going on?
Well, the biggest stakeholder as far as property is concerned is Morgan County, just because of where the county line is and where the run ends. Summit County, of course, is also involved, and the DWR, so the state of Utah, where the popular put-in for the boaters is at exit 112 on I-84. The property owners along the way include the Wholesome Cement Company, several other ranching and farming interests along the way. There's another piece of DWR property near the Taggart Railroad Bridge. And I would say that the biggest stakeholder is the public. And I think the public gets left out of a lot of the conversation because the other stakeholders, property holding stakeholders, get more attention.
Sure. So talk to us a little bit about the garbage problems and the rowdiness and some of the maybe even lack of preparedness on the part of the recreationists there.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of the independent tube riders, they seem to be the biggest problem. They come unprepared. They don't understand the rig-to-flip mentality because some of them think that it's a lazy river. It is a class, some people call it a class three. It's between class two and three whitewater. And if somebody gets flipped, they're going to lose everything that isn't clipped onto their tube. So that ends up being a problem. Some of the cheap tubes that they can get at Walmart before they get to the river, sometimes they're just too cheap and they'll pop. If those tubes get left behind on the river, that really makes people angry. The rafting outfitters are trying to provide an experience that people will remember and sometime in the future come back. So the trash and the lewdness and things like that, the drunkenness, it needs to be brought under control. It's difficult because of the jurisdictions, but I think there's progress being made. The Morgan County Council voted to make the Taggart area an official river access area. So now they can allocate money to things like road improvements, and they have. They've filled in potholes. They've added to the shoulders. And for the first time in over 15 years, there are dumpsters and porta potties available, and I think things are going to improve very soon.
Yeah, so is it the type of thing that does need more regulation? Should permitting be done in that section?
I don't know. I've heard some of the outfitters, some of them really think that it should be a permitted river. I don't know if it needs to go that far or not, because that adds more bureaucracy and more government involvement. And I think that has to come to a balance where everybody can kind of get along without anything being too heavy-handed. I understand the concerns of the outfitters, but I don't think the public should be pushed out with or by regulations. I think it's something that awareness can help with. If we can teach those people that if they, you know, a tube that costs $5 more might last 5 years longer. And if we can teach them, things like that, and the idea that if they clip things to their tubes, it might make a bigger difference than going heavy-handed.
Well, sure. And you had mentioned that there are now some porta potties and dumpsters at the Taggart portion. What about at the put-in? Is the put-in up by Hennifer for some of
the?
So what about up there? What's happening?
Yeah, the DWR has a really nice put in. It's just off exit 112 on I-84. It has parking. It has fences. It's got porta potties and trash cans. They even have painted parking spaces when they know it's going to be busy. It's got several access points, and that place is really, really nice. But it's because it's DWR owned. It's difficult to get people to make a commitment to an area until they're ready to take on ownership of it, and that's something that Morgan has done recently. What's going on at the DWR put in is and has been pretty smooth for a while. There's still a little bit of trash. I would say people start drinking way too early, but I don't know how that's going to be controlled. But for the most part, the DWR put in is kind of the model of the way things should be.
Yeah, so as far as enforcement, so that people don't get in the water without strapping their belongings down properly, is there a representative from DWR there kind of guiding that, or is there signage, or how does that work?
Well, so far, the DWR seems to be mostly interested in enforcing the life jacket regulations that exist and the drinking and drugs that they might find along the way. So they will sometimes put someone in undercover on a tube. They'll float with people and mingle a little bit, and they'll just try to see what's going on. It's difficult for DWR to be everywhere at once. It is a 6-mile reach of the river. So it, I think, is going to come down to some self-policing from the people on the river. For example, if somebody has a beer bottle, that would be something that would get the attention of nearly everybody on the river. So I would say if they're going to have anything, it would be an aluminum can or a reusable can. It's, you know, the trashiness is sort of inevitable, but it can be, I think, scaled back if people have proper maybe a little bit of motivation, maybe a little peer pressure.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, if you have the facilities to handle the trash, places for people
right.
to put things. There was an interesting thing that you posted on your website that sort of outlines just how long certain items of trash take to decompose.
Right.
Like, an example, diapers, 450 years, that type of thing. Glass bottle, 4,000 years, and cigarette butts, 10 years to basically decompose. So is it getting better? Has there been an improvement in the last year since our last reporting on this?
I think it has improved. I think that one thing that really helps is when investments are made to an area and people sort of see that the mood is changing, people will, I think, not fall into lockstep, but I think they will sort of fall into line a little bit behind the ideas. I've seen a lot of people that are gathering trash on their own and putting it in the dumpsters. It's, you know, the dumpsters weren't there before at the takeout. So it was maybe a pile of trash here and there, and there was no accountability or any kind of representation from any government. So having the trash cans there, being paid for by Morgan County is going to be helpful. And I think that if people will just sort of tidy up, clean up after themselves as they float or as they recreate, I think it'll make a big difference. There's always going to be a few problems because the area sees between 3,000 and 5,000 people per week. So there's always going to be difficulties. The idea, I think, would be to try to educate as many people that are interested in being educated and want to see the area succeed and try to get them on board with some better behaviors and better attitudes. And I think that will maybe sort of by osmosis spread to the people around them, and hopefully everybody will kind of clean up their act and the area will improve.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, Dylan. Thank you. Dylan Taggart is Friends of the Hentag of the Weber River. I guess you've got a Facebook page people could go to if they want to follow the progress or make comments and participate in the conversation.
Yeah, we really hope people will do that, people that are interested in the area, people that care. Join the group and find out what we're doing.
Yeah. Okay, thank you so much for joining us.
All right, thanks.
Bye now. Well, it is 8:27. My next guest is Alfred Knotts. He's the Park City Transportation Manager. And Park City Municipal is in the process of, well, tonight, holding a public input session. There's a discussion on the Comprehensive Old Town Access and Circulation Plan. And joining us to explain just what the city is looking at here is Alfred Knotts. Thanks for coming by, Alfred.
Good morning.
So, yeah, tonight the city is hosting a Q&A, I guess. And the session is to cover some upcoming projects to improve Old Town access and circulation. But can you first define what you're talking about as Old Town? Does it go down as far as Park City Mountain? Or where is the line there?
It does not. It's pretty much bound by the 9th Street area and then up in the Hillside area and then the residential streets up at Norfolk and Woodside in that area also, King Road, and trying to keep it scalable, but also a little more defined as much as we can also, so we don't have this broad kind of scope creep also, and making sure that we can come up with a plan and an action plan and projects that are fundable, financially feasible in the near term. So that's really the goal tonight.
Okay, so what is what's the outline for tonight? How will it work?
And the outline is really kind of a Q&A. So we're really trying to establish the defined scope. We do have an RFP out right now, so a request for proposals for consultants for the work on the project. So it's really to kind of drive what that scope looks like. It's obviously defined, as I mentioned, in terms of geography and goals and objectives. But once we get a consultant on board, we really want to be able to drill down on what the overall contractual scope of work is also, and making sure that that's attainable, again, both financially and it also meets the expectations of council and the community as well.
So we've had some pretty vocal neighborhoods through the last number of years, particularly when there are very big events going on, one being down by the Kimball, the other being up around Hillside. I imagine there's a lot of other chatter going on out there. What actually are you considering as far as feasible projects that could be done?
Well, one thing that we kind of, that we chipped off was just the reversal of Fifth Street. That actually does have a broader objective. It wasn't just arbitrarily decided that we were going to flip it. Specifically, it does eliminate left-hand turning movements. So that did improve safety. It also improved pedestrian visibility, eliminating those left-hand turning movements. So what we want to look at too is the other phase of that, or I guess the next step would be looking at 4th Street and to turn that into a one-way also eastbound. So that's something we are looking at. Right now it's a very dangerous situation. You have a lot of kids and families out there, Java Cow, and just in general, pedestrians crossing there, you can't see anyone until you are literally on the sidewalk. So
yeah, so to pinpoint, let's 4th Street is right near the Java Cow,
yes.
And it connects Main Street with Sweet Alley.
Correct.
Right.
Yes, and then providing a pedestrian refuge in that area, whether it be a sidewalk or some type of area that's delineated for pedestrians to get through there. Again, it's not very safe. So that's just one of the areas we've already started to look at in the interim, and then also looking at taxi and shuttle staging areas potentially on Swede. But again, all this stuff needs to be looked at comprehensively. We can't just kind of one off these things without looking at what does it do to the broader system? What does it do to other impacts? Does the impact get pushed somewhere else, which is typically the case? We have such a confined road network in Old Town. You know, people talk about, you know, turning Old or Main Street into one way or, you know, turning it into a closed pedestrian area, which, again, that's something that may be part of this scope just to look at. But when you look at just conceptually taking out one road in Old Town, you essentially one road equals about 25% of the road network. So where does that traffic go? We're trying to eliminate or reduce traffic in the area, but we still have to plan for the automobile to a certain extent also. So being able to look at all that, look at wayfinding too, signage, again, comprehensively, and putting it all into one action plan. So we can go back to council and say, this is what it's going to cost to do these. What are our priorities? We've allocated a little bit of money to it, but for the broader scope of the work, it's going to require additional financial resources. And council's made it clear to us that it's a priority to them and to the community.
So tell our listeners what wayfinding means.
Wayfinding is really just, I would say it's signage, but it's aesthetically pleasing signage. It's not your highway signage. So it's not, you know, stop ahead, those types of traffic control devices. It's really for people that visit resort towns or commercial districts where they're not necessarily familiar with, it's really intuitive wayfinding signage to, you know, that's internationally kind of signed. So it makes sense to a broader, you know, community and broader demographic. And again, hits the residents, hits the visitors, children, anybody. So it makes it a lot more easier to comprehend.
So things like on Main Street, it would say parking garage this way or that type of thing?
Correct. And then you know, the signage itself, whether it be font size, color, little things like that are all universal. So it starts having a broader theme, so you know what it means and what it's trying to instruct you to do, whether it's even getting to the transit center, directing you to, you know, some of the pedestrian malls areas such as Bear Bench Plaza in the Trigo area, just getting people through the areas where you want them to go. And again, try to provide something on 4th Street because people do gravitate to that just coming out of the parking garage, but it's really not a safe access point at this time.
So just going back to this longtime conversation between our business owners on Main Street and many people who have lived in Park City for a long time, it's been talked about shutting Main Street down to traffic or making it one way, that kind of thing. Can you give us an overview? What are the pros and cons?
Well, there's economic impacts that may be not foreseen also. There's safety issues that may not be foreseen just with safety access, emergency access. And again, excuse me, just looking where that traffic goes, looking at that broader model, and again, wayfinding. If you're going to close that down, you can't have, or any street, having people get to an area where they can't circulate out of. So again, it just kind of needs to be looked at as one big plan also. And again, this isn't just the term study kind of gets thrown around a little too much. A plan is an actionable implementation plan. So we want to make sure that's very clear. This is not some type of just a study that says you could do this, you could do that. It's going to come out with very defined project goals and very defined project objectives in a list, an implementation list that accomplishes those goals and objectives.
So you've got, as the transportation director manager, you've got a lot of projects going on.
Yes.
Here's another one. You're talking about an RFP for someone to guide the process, but there's an implementation limitation, correct?
There is, but and that's something we need to define too, is what the scope is and what the prioritization is, and then you know, kind of a near-term plan of implementation of about whether it be 1 to 3 years, 1 to 5 years, and then what's the financial resources to what it's going to require to do that, with coming up with a more defined engineer's estimate. And it can be as simple as some paint for a taxi shuttle load zone, or it could be as intensive as intersection improvements and things like that that are require more engineering and more financial cost, obviously.
Okay. What about other projects in the area, in the town as a whole? What else do you have going on? Obviously, the tunnel is underway.
Yes.
Yep. We've got school starting soon, next week.
We do. And we did start that project early with the hope of being completed before school starts. It does not look like that's going to be the case. We've had a lot of delays related to utilities, conflicts that were not mapped, which is not abnormal. Typically, utilities are laid in roadways, and sometimes they're not necessarily as planned. You know, the as-built plans don't necessarily define them. So and there is exploration that occurs, and then you find the certain utilities. So that's taken a little bit of time. Also, delivery of materials has taken a little bit longer in terms of rebar and things like that that go into the actual structure itself. We've had a few weather delays. We had a very wet spring and early summer, so we've had some weather delays there. So we're working with the school district to make sure that the school campus is as functional as possible. They've been a great partner. We've been communicating with them essentially daily for the most part, and finishing work on the north side is the objective, so that impact of the school can be mitigated to the maximum extent practical. And then on the south side, I'm starting the excavation over there as well.
So has the excavation started on the north side? Are you
yes.
starting to dig through?
Okay. Oh, yeah.
And the staging, of course, is going on in the parking lot. How much parking space is being taken up, and will that become available once school does start, or what's going to happen
That's
there?
A discussion right now with the school district, what's acceptable to them. We've tried to move as much material off the site as possible also, so they're not staging and storing materials such as spoil piles and stockpiling. So, you know, anywhere between 15 to 20 spaces is what exists in that front row. And that's where we would look to maybe be able to stage there also, like we did at the beginning of the project also. But again, that's a negotiation with the school district that needs to occur, because their expectation was that this project would be completed by then, and so is ours.
Sure. So what is the timeline?
We're looking at probably mid-September. So there will be probably a month delay, but once it's all done, it'll be a wonderful project, much safer crossing, again, a very beautiful structure. As much of a tunnel can be beautiful, it'll be a very well-designed tunnel, and yeah, it'll be hopefully out of sight, out of mind once everything's completed and people forget about the pain we go through when you do these projects, and mm-hmm. The end result is a very, very good project that's better for traffic, and then also again, safety is paramount.
Yeah, so there are still traffic restrictions in place in that spot. Will those remain through school starting? And
they will. We've been able to keep everything open in two lanes, directional, so it hasn't been a significant impact. It's more of just that the safety component of traveling through a construction site, and then that friction of just work activity and people looking about what's going on and that type of delay that it does cause, but not any type of delay where you would actually have traffic control and holding traffic at this point.
And, of course, there's the seminary students that cross there all through the day. What's been discussed with the LDS Church across the way there?
What we are looking at is a temporary hawk signal there, and then we also did active pedestrian management at the beginning of it also. But we are looking at an actual signalized temporary structure that would be deployed out there.
So the old one was taken away basically when the construction started, so
yeah.
Put another one in.
It was a UDOT structure, They've taken that away, and we've stored it, and we might have the opportunity to use it somewhere else in the future.
And you'd mentioned earlier on that the mapping of infrastructure there has been a little surprising, as can be the case when you have, you know, old utilities or, you know, things that have been put in the past. So what happens? Is there some process where your team or somebody from Public Works maps what really is happening under there for future reference, or how does that work?
They will. They'll mark it up in the field as part of the as-built. So that does show with everything, because the plans don't always result in the actual design project, no matter what it is. So, okay, what was actually built versus what was designed. So that is captured in the as-built process, and that is what gets documented and filed as the end of the project.
And the gas leak that had occurred there 10 days or so ago, and then again there was another gas leak in the adjacent neighborhood in the same area. Were those related at all?
No, we did not do the second one. No, we did not. That was confirmed. It actually was, I think Questar was just out actually doing their just audits and assessment, and they located it just by being out in the field and doing their due diligence like they do. So we want to thank them for that as well.
Okay.
And, and all the work that they did in our police department when the other incident occurred too. So
yeah,
we're very fortunate that nothing happened and the kids weren't in school and there wasn't that type of evacuation that had to occur. And we want to apologize to the residents in the area that did have to get evacuated also. But again, I don't want to say this is commonplace, but it isn't, you know, it does happen.
Yeah, it does happen. Let's move on and talk a little bit about just last week's council retreat. I guess you mentioned a sort of reworking of the Dial-A-Ride program and turning it into a Quinns neighborhood connectivity project. What do you mean by all this? What do you have in mind?
Well, our Dial-A-Ride is very inefficient. It does serve a very critical purpose. It is a more of a, you know, when we talk to council, we talk to the community, there's a variety of different objectives when you look at public transportation. So some of them could be, they don't always pencil out. Public transportation never makes money, that's for sure, even if we do charge a fare. But there's a, you know, sometimes there's a social goal, sometimes there's an economic goal, an employment goal, you know, access to medical services, or it could even be just access to, like around here, in recreation and trip generators. So our Dial-A-Ride serves a very critical purpose with accessing the Quinns Junction medical facilities out there and the health clinic and the obviously the hospital and our recreation facilities. But it's very inefficient. It runs whether people, it's named a Dial-A-Ride, but it runs no matter what. So it's on 15-minute headways. It runs from 8 in the morning until 9 o'clock in the evening, whether we're picking up somebody or not. So one of the objectives, I think, of this would be to look at other ride booking applications, such as on-demand, whether it's a app-based service, scheduling software, and be able to pick people up more on demand response and serve other areas, such as the Homestake shuttle area. So it could serve multiple purposes, so we don't have just that shuttle running, because we're looking at bringing that back in the winter. Serving the Park City Heights area, our biggest affordable housing, or one of our primary affordable housing, attainable housing projects, is not really currently served by transit. And our the county and the city feel that the medical area and facilities out there are underserved also. So this is an objective to look at, a small window pilot project of, you know, how can we better serve this? And maybe obviously the goal would be to reduce cost. Cost may not be come down significantly, because the driver is the primary cost of most of our services, so we still have to have a driver on. But tailpipe emissions and emissions per passenger most likely will come down also, and those are metrics that we'll identify prior to implementation.
Well, the Trailside neighborhood has been pretty bereft of having any kind of direct transportation. There, a lot of the people in that neighborhood say it takes an hour to get into town or longer because they have to go all the way around. Is there any possibility of connecting those two neighborhoods coming through the back way to 48 and providing transit services to that neighborhood that is more direct and more more streamlined and hopefully maybe more used?
That is an opportunity. Once we get something like this in place, then we can look at how we want to build off of it also. So really that's what we've done with the electric and the white line, is how do we build off of that and leverage that service. This would be similar also. And do we build the demand through this pilot project, then it becomes the potential of it to become more of a fixed route service also. So, and we are looking at a Quinns Junction park and ride facility out there that we'll be bringing back to council in the coming weeks also, about a parcel out there we've been analyzing and potential park and ride facility out by the frontage area.
So not Richardson Flat.
We did look at that also. That's part of the analysis that we're doing, is new facility, but improved access to Richardson and or both. So we're going to come back to council and produce or present the pros and the cons of that and decide how we want to move forward.
Okay. And then I guess finally, what's happening with UDOT and their decision on the 248 environmental draft?
They are still going through incorporating the comments and responding to comments. So that goes all into the document. We received approximately 350 comments, I believe. So we're going ahead and digesting all those. And then our executive team, and including the mayor and the executive side of UDOT, are discussing maybe a smaller scalable project that we talked about as part of our presented in the resolution we signed too. That's something that meets broader objectives in terms of pedestrian bicycle facilities, which we do have bike lanes in there, but transit being the primary objective on the corridor, at least from the city's perspective.
Well, and it seems to me that it would have a pretty close relationship to the work you're doing now with the Quinns Transit project.
Very much so.
They have to tie together.
Yeah, correct? They all do tie together. The Arts and Culture District ties together. So looking at trying to build this service as the neighborhood connectivity project and improving on a service that we already provide, seeing how we can do it better and serve a broader community rather than just the Dial-A-Ride's primary objective right now is just to get people kind of to and from the hospital. But now we have residential communities out there. We have a lot of recreation facilities, as we know. But this does all tie together. And then where do we park people outside of the corridor to achieve our objectives of reducing traffic volumes on our entry corridors?
Yeah. Okay. We're going to have to leave it there, Alfred. Thank you very much. I appreciate you coming by.
You've got
a lot going on.
We all do.
Just a quick reminder for the meeting tonight.
Yes. It is tonight at the community room in the library. It starts at 5. Again, it'll be a Q&A type of a process. We want to get feedback from the entire community, even those that live outside the Old Town area, because obviously we all come here, and it is, it does serve a lot of our purposes and having to come down here. So we want to hear from everybody, and then we will move forward on a plan and select a consultant team over the next couple of weeks.
Okay. Thanks so much. That's Alfred Knotts. He is the transportation manager for Park City, and I appreciate you coming by.
Thank you. I appreciate it as well.
It's 8:47. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. My next guest on the line is Eagle Scout Tanner Crosby, and he is working on a project to dispose of flags in a decent and respectful way. Thank you for joining us this morning, Tanner. I know you've got a busy morning. How are you?
Yes. Good. How are you?
Good, thank you. So tell us a little bit about your project, please.
So my project is a flag retirement box. It is a box that is for worn and torn flags that you can put the worn and torn flags in the box at the Summit County Library. And my troop will come and get the flags for when they go to scout camps, and then they can retire them.
Okay, so what got you started on this?
Mm-hmm.
How did you get started on this, Tanner?
Oh, so since we have so many flags in our in our basement that it's like we don't know what to do with them. So then me and my dad had a idea to have a flag retirement box from an eagle, and so I was like, that's a great idea, and we should definitely do that because there's no place to actually put your worn, your torn flag. So we just had the idea just to have a flag retirement box for the whole community.
Sure. So can you tell us, a lot of listeners may not know what the proper disposal process is for a worn or torn flag.
Yes. So if you have a worn and torn flag and you are a veteran or an Eagle or a Boy Scout, you can burn it. You have to fold it. So on my box, there is going to be on the top, there's going to show you how to fold a flag. And you can either look up on your phone and see how you can fold it, and then you can retire it, or you can just give it to an Eagle or a veteran so you could for them to retire.
Okay, and what will your disposal bin look like? I saw some things, some renderings, I guess, on your flyer. What do you have in mind there?
So my flag, since I think it's against the law to have a blue mailbox for people might think it's like a, it's a just like a normal mailbox. So like that's not gonna help. So it's like a American flag color, and it has like all American flags, and it has like the eagle logo on the sides of it, and it'll have my name. It will just have the American flags everywhere, and then have like the one big red, white, and blue all around the box.
Okay, so it will not be difficult to find it then.
Yes.
Okay, and is this bin up and running already?
We are in like 20 minutes. We are gonna pour the concrete, and so the box is getting painted right now. And it's probably going to be done by this week, probably.
Okay. Just in time for school to start and you to get back and focus your energies, I guess, on some hard work and studying and that kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
All right. Hey, that is a great project. Thank you. What a service to our community. Very much appreciated. Okay. Good luck, Tanner. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, this is our last guest with the Local News Hour this morning. It is Deer Valley Senior Communications Manager Emily Summers. She's here to talk about events this weekend at Deer Valley. And then maybe we'll also get a little bit of a rundown on this culinary team that will be going to New York City to participate in the James Beard House event in October. Thank you for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
So, yeah, we've got some events coming this weekend, I understand. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday?
Oh, big weekend. It's starting tonight. We have five shows in a row. We start tonight with a free community concert series with Mountain Town Music. And then we go into four nights of big programming. So Thursday and Sunday are the next two shows in the Deer Valley Concert Series, Lucas Nelson and then Ben Harper and Trombone Shorty. But really what we want to remind everyone is Friday and Saturday are the last two performances of the Deer Valley Music Festival, so with the Utah Symphony. And right now those are fairly large shows. We're expecting really good attendance. And in that case, we're doing some extra transportation initiatives there. We have satellite parking that'll start at 4 p.m. at McPolin and Treasure Mountain Middle School. And we're being supplemented with the city, and we have direct bus routes from those satellite parking at the schools right to Deer Valley. So they're adding a direct line, again, at 4 p.m., and it'll take you right to the door of Snow Park Lodge. So just those are Friday and Saturday, just based on attendance expectations.
And that's good. That's Friday, Saturday. So Thursday and Sunday, you're not going to be doing that program.
Not necessary. Yeah, normal business, not necessary. Okay. Numbers aren't really calling for that. But Friday and Saturday, we are. It's just a big couple days coming up, the end of the symphony shows. So just want people to be prepared and expect some extra travel time on those nights.
Okay. And then my understanding is the egress traffic patterns after the show. Talk a little bit about what those are.
Yes. We've been working with kind of a newer traffic pattern for departures on those big concert nights. So just being aware when you park, you are going to be, depending on where you park at Deer Valley, you will be directed a certain way to exit. We're working with the Park City Police Department and the city on that. So you will have parking attendants, but it's just a pattern to try to get people out in a more seamless way. But there will be people directing you depending on where you park. Again, we really recommend that bus system, especially if you're bringing chairs and your cooler, you're going to get dropped off at the door. But just expect for kind of a busy pattern.
Well, especially on the Friday-Saturday shows, it is a very much more direct way to get to the venue and to get to your spot, rather than, you know, hauling all your gear through the parking lots.
The bus is, we always say the benefit of the bus is front door service. So.
Will the egress offer bus transit lanes? Will there be any ability to do that?
We don't have the space for that, but we don't have extra lanes. However, buses will get priority, and they are built around getting the bus out of the snow park area as well.
Okay. And what are we expecting in terms of crowds? Do you have any sense of that?
Well, they aren't sold out, and we tend to do this traffic plan when our venue's at about 75%. So we're probably looking at somewhere around like 3,000 expectation for those bigger shows. We're just preparing for quite a few shows the next few days.
And it is rain or shine.
It is rain or shine, yes.
And it looks like Saturday, Sunday are going to be pretty steady, but maybe we may have a few showers on
Wednesday,
Thursday.
Keep your eye on that forecast and bring your rain gear.
Yeah. Well, and it's always fun.
Yeah.
Even when it is coming down. I've sat there before and enjoyed myself entirely.
Yes.
Okay, so let's talk about the James Beard House event. These tickets are on sale now?
They went on sale yesterday.
Okay.
So if everyone remembers kind of the big push this time last year, the Park City Restaurant Association took five restaurants to the James Beard House, and they were so grateful for that dinner and the experience that they invited us to come back. And so Deer Valley is going to do a Deer Valley themed night and feature five of our restaurants on October 25th at the James Beard House in New York. And it'll be a couple of our chefs' first time going, and Jody Rogers, our director of food and beverage, is heading up that team and returning. And we're just really excited to have the opportunity to kind of take what we do here and showcases it in such a legendary location, and it's an honor. And that'll be October 25th in Manhattan.
Okay, and tickets, you said they are on sale now. How much are they?
They are $180 to the general public. James Beard House also has a member discount, but the whole list is on their website as well.
And the James Beard Foundation, talk a little, do you know very much about what their organization does? And
yes, they do quite a few things. Their foundation extends beyond the house, and the house is their location in Manhattan, but they do programming and education for students wanting to get into the culinary field. They do things around sustainability and farm to table, and Chef Jody Rogers has been invited to go to quite a few. She did a farm to table education event in Vermont a few years ago, has been invited back to go to New Jersey this October to do another educational event. So it's really just bringing the standards of food and beverage to a higher quality, as well as chef education and chef, you know, promotion. It's just another level and recognition in the food and beverage industry.
Mm-hmm. And they also have leadership programs that advance women in
yes,
the field.
Yes, they do.
Mm-hmm. It's traditionally been a very male-dominated area.
Correct, but, and I think that's where Jody Rogers has been really involved as well.
Sure, sure. And then as far as the cuisine, will it be geared towards mountain? I mean, is there a mountain cuisine? Can we say?
We like to think so. Yes, okay. It is. The menu is posted with the tickets. It is going to be a 5-course meal that focuses on the restaurants at Deer Valley. So, course around seafood buffet, the Goldener Hirsch, Mariposa. We are serving things like Utah lamb. So, yes, it's programmed as a regional spotlight. So, we really are focusing on this region.
Okay, excellent. We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much. This is Deer Valley Senior Communications Manager Emily Summers. And remember to take the bus.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for coming by.